You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. This is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. And today is Wednesday, March 7th, 2007. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Jay's in Hawaii and I'm not.
Rebecca Watson.
Hi, everyone.
Perry DeAngelis.
My very presence is premium content.
And Evan Bernstein.
The Ides of March are on us all. Good evening, everyone.
We got a week left of the Ides.
Oh, okay. Well,
I feel like I should have come up with something clever to say.
No, that's okay. It's quite all right. Jay is indeed in Hawaii while we're all freezing our behinds off in New England. This is like the coldest week in New England all winter.
No, that's not.
Yeah, the wind chill's like below zero. We have this.
It was cold. It was a little colder a few weeks ago because then it got warm last week, and I said, if it's that cold again, I'm going to kill myself.
Oh, was that when? Was that the week I was in Florida?
Yeah, I think it might have been.
Okay,
actually,
this is my coldest week in New England.
It's been a relatively mild winter.
It has been.
All right, enough with the weather.
And now for the skeptical news. We actually have a few interesting news items this week. The first one is a study which is being published in this week's Journal of the American Medical Association.
Also known as JAMA.
This is a comparison of four popular diets. The Atkins diet, which is a super low-carb diet. The Zone diet, which is a moderately low-carbohydrate or low-carb diet. The LEARN diet, which basically follows the Department of Agriculture's food pyramid and also includes some lifestyle changes.
The new one or the old one?
I hope the new one. And the Ornish diet, which is basically low fat. They did the study in 300 overweight women, and they followed them for 1 year. After 1 year, the Atkins group lost an average of approximately 10 pounds, while the LEARN diet lost an average of 5.7 pounds. The Ornish, 4.8 pounds, and the Zone, 3.5 pounds. So that is being touted in the press as tipping the scales, if you will, towards the Atkins plan. Although we've talked about these so-called fat diets.
Atkins is the one where you can shove steaks down your mouth, right?
Well, it's high fat, high protein, very, very low carbohydrate. It's really difficult to interpret these studies because there's so many factors at play. And I think actually the researchers are being very reasonable in how they're interpreting the evidence. Although the lay press headlines always sort of boil it down to Atkins, works, but it did show what previous studies have shown in that weight loss was in proportion to compliance with the diet and therefore caloric intake. So if you ate less, you lost weight on all
diets.
Gee,
what a shock. Have to comply?
Yeah. The Atkins diet was most successful because the women were more compliant with that diet.
Because you can shove steaks down your mouth.
Well, what they said is that it's mainly because it's easier. Which also complies with what previous studies have shown, which that...
Isn't that what I just said?
Well, it's easier in that it's simpler to know what you can and cannot eat. Not that it's easier, not that it's more pleasurable, therefore it's easier to comply with because you have better stuff to eat. It's easier to say just don't eat sugar, and stop drinking Coke and start drinking water. Those are sort of easier changes to make.
Well, I got some easier. Just eat, no matter what you're eating, eat a little less and more. It's even easier. Let's do that, people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's simpler, we should say. There's nothing easy about dieting and losing weight.
Right.
It's simpler.
Right.
And the Atkins diet
easy, skinny person.
Was simple. And that is probably the primary factor here. They also talked about maybe there was, that the low-carb, high-protein diet was more satisfying and produced less hunger. But, if you combine that with previous evidence, that effect only seems to last for about 6 months. So it's hard to know how much of a factor that was in this comparison. The other thing to keep in mind is that, even an average of 10 pounds of weight loss, which is the most for any of the groups in the study, over a year, that's pretty modest. That is hardly
impressive.
And these were significantly overweight people. So, yeah, that's not impressive. And there were some people in each of the four groups that lost up to 30 pounds, but there was not much of a difference. So basically, no matter what diet you try, if you're going to be compliant with it and you're going to work hard, you can lose a lot of weight. And then these are really sort of minor differences, all at the low end of the spectrum in terms of the overall amount of weight loss. Probably has more to do with, you know, just how simple it is to comply, and compliance is probably the primary factor. So there's still it really isn't convincing evidence that the proportion of macronutrients, you know, protein, fat, and carbohydrates that one eats in and of itself has a significant effect on metabolism, so that it affects how many calories you burn or how many calories you lose. There were other factors that they followed, and you know, this also correlated with earlier studies in that in all four groups, blood pressure and cholesterol levels dropped. And that was proportional to the amount of weight that was lost. So that was better in the Atkins group, but that was probably just because they lost more weight in the Atkins group, and it did seem to be proportional to the amount of weight loss. So even the high-fat diets, if you lose weight, the weight loss trumps the high-fat in terms of your – at least over a year. Now, the researchers are saying we don't know how this would play out over 5 or 10 years. At least over the 1 year, the weight loss was the dominant factor. They also mentioned that, you know, even towards the end, Atkins admitted that it's not that that the type of fat is important, and that's not something that these low fat diet that I'm sorry the low carbohydrate high fat diets that a lot of them talk about. Some do, like the South Beach diet. I think it's into types of sugars and types of fat. But the bottom line is, if you eat more vegetable fat, less animal fat, that will also have a positive impact on your cholesterol and your heart health, and that wasn't really taken into account in this comparison.
And another little tidbit was that the Atkins group was the group that had the at the last half of the year they gained more weight back more than any of the other groups, which I thought was interesting.
Which again correlates with our earlier studies that shows that all of the advantages is in the first 6 months, and then they gained the weight back. So if you extrapolate that out for 2 years. You know, maybe it doesn't look so good. And the one study I'm familiar with where they actually what they did is they looked at people who had lost more than 50 pounds and kept more than, I think, 80% off over 5 years. And then they said, what diet had they used? And this is a retrospective study, so it wasn't controlled. But in that study, the low-fat diet had the best long-term outcomes. So, you know, I didn't really think that this study added much to the body of literature. It's an interesting comparison. It was kind of a real-world comparison between
nice
these
twist.
Diets, but it really didn't change what we already knew, and it doesn't.
I had a friend of mine do Atkins. He had exactly that dramatic weight loss, gained it all back quite quickly.
Gained it all back. Yeah. Long-term compliance is the key, and that's the one thing that none of these diets really do well.
That's why diets. I think diets in general just should not be followed. If you need to lose weight, just make a permanent change in your diet and something that you can live with and stick with it. And you won't even see it as a diet. You'll say, this is how I eat now, and this is what I eat now, and just make it permanent. Don't even think
of
it as a diet. Because studies that I'm familiar with, when you go out to 5 years, the overwhelming majority, 95%, something like that, will fail. So just don't even try a diet. Make a permanent change.
Next up, water's wet. Steve, tell us more about it.
I want to know what the weather's going to be like tomorrow in New England, personally.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those really obvious things. Eat less, work out more. But, you know, there's an entire multi-billion dollar industry, basically designed around telling people other things other than that, trying to convince them that you can lose weight without, like, actually having to reduce your caloric intake or exercise.
Well, hypnosis. So, I use hypnosis.
Everyone wants a panacea. They want a magic pill, and that's what they're looking for. That's what makes you so appealing. It's easier than the hard work that's really required.
Just for human interest, there were two other weight-related headlines this week on Drudge. One was 420-pound woman had a stomachache, went to the doctor, gave birth to a healthy baby.
Yeah, I saw that.
No idea she was pregnant. The other headline said 820-pound woman dies of heart attack. And I'm thinking to myself, they wrote a headline for this?
Yeah, why is that news?
I thought maybe 820-pound woman survives heart attack. That might be news.
That would be news.
Right? But then when I looked it up, she had recently had the stomach stapling. I guess that's why it was news.
Probably incidental. I mean, you know, it's
probably
a heart attack because you weighed over 800 pounds. And actually, a lot of people who are really like over 500-600 pounds, really massively overweight, who lose lots of weight quickly, you know, they there's a high mortality rate as that's happening,
right?
So losing a lot of weight quickly can be unhealthy, and you know it's actually not uncommon for overweight women to come in labor, and they never knew they were pregnant.
And just
that's,
not know
that's
it.
Not a, that's not a unique case. That is not uncommon at all.
It's amazing. Amazing. Yeah.
You would think the whole loss of periods for 9 months would have clued them in too. But,
well, that doesn't always happen though, does it?
You always stop menstruating. You may have a false menstruation like once or twice, but it's
over 9 months.
Yeah, but you're not going to be menstruating every month for the pregnancy. Yeah. Maybe they say, well, they were irregular to begin with or whatever.
That's what I believe the article said. She'd not menstruated for 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
As part of the, complications from obesity.
What about that thing moving inside her body? Is that kind of.
She said she couldn't feel it,
I guess.
Well, I mean, other people that aren't maybe 800 pounds.
Thought it was gas.
Yeah, what's it feel like to be 800 pounds? I mean, I imagine things are always moving. You don't know what they are.
Well, no. The woman who was pregnant was 420. The 800-pound person.
Oh, yeah, right.
Let's not get confused.
Yeah, right.
Let's not get confused.
Sorry. My point stands.
I'll suspend my comment. Go ahead.
The next item. Now, this comes – actually, several of our listeners sent this to us, and it was also posted on the message board by a couple of people. There is a podcast, a relatively new podcast out there called Skeptico with a K. Although it's actually only pretending to be skeptical. I mean, it's not really a skeptical podcast. It's basically being run by believers in the paranormal.
It's hysterical. It's like Sylvia Brown wearing a beard and glasses and showing up at TAMS, claiming to be Randy.
Yeah, calling yourself the skeptic psychic or whatever.
Yeah,
right.
It's a bait and switch. But the reason why they were sending us notification of this is because on one of the episodes they interviewed Marilyn Schlitz, and Marilyn was on our podcast about a year ago, and they actually included a clip from the Skeptic's Guide. It actually wasn't the episode where we interviewed her, but one a few weeks later, I think, where we mentioned her as we were talking about something. And they used a clip of that basically to bash me for being a bad skeptic, to being a closed-minded, evil skeptic.
Well, but you used the word kook.
I used the word kook. So it's worth reviewing because it's actually
you
very interesting.
Say kook.
I said she has some kooky beliefs, which is different. I'd not call her a kook.
Key difference there, key.
It's a key difference.
As we shall see.
I think this is very useful to discuss because it's very interesting to listen to the pro paranormal crowd, especially those that try to be scientific, not the really bizarre anti-scientific ones, but the ones who really think that they're being scientific, and how they talk about skeptics. It says a lot about sort of the differences in the culture, and also sometimes they say things that are very eerily reminiscent of the kind of things that we might
say.
Absolutely. For example, explaining why they believe what they do, and they're sort of thinking that they need to like sociologically explain why skeptics are the way they are, because obviously it's not based upon the evidence, right? So
she even says that, Steve. She says regarding your comments, where's the evidence? And I just almost fell out of my car when I heard that.
So the comment that they used of mine, which I think they used completely out of context, we were talking about the fact that the people who believe in sort of one paranormal thing tend to believe in other paranormal things. They tend to believe in usually a very large number of paranormal things because they have a different approach. They have a different, I said, worldview. And I used Marilyn Schlitz as an example because she had recently been on our show. We were talking to her mainly about psi phenomenon and ESP, but it's not as if she is a practicing scientist who believes in ESP and otherwise has fairly mainstream views. She also believes in a lot of other paranormal things, which I characterize as other kooky beliefs. For example, she is very compelled by the evidence for distant healing, and she spends a lot of her time researching these things. And I think that says something about the overall worldview and approach that people take. There's a reason why skeptics believe in none of these things, and so-called either true believers or paranormal proponents, whatever, believe all of them. That was the point I was making. But they used that sentence, and they sort of took it out of context to say that, one, that by saying that Marilyn has some kooky beliefs, that was an ad hominem attack against her, yep. which is not true.
The quote was almost an ad hominem attack.
Almost.
Just to be accurate.
What does that mean? They also said that I was...
It's like that woman who was almost pregnant.
Right. that I was dismissing the belief and her research and her credentials and dismissing the evidence, which that
she
is completely unfair. That's completely unfair to say that we're dismissive, either us, the skeptical community in general, that we as a group, that me personally. I mean, seriously.
Yeah, the quote that they picked was from a conversation where we were discussing why people are the way they are,
yeah.
And nothing to do with specifically what Marilyn has researching.
Right, so, and it was just one point. It was just the point that these 10 beliefs tend to go together. And guess what? They do. You know, Marilyn does believe a lot of these other things. The people on the show are endorsing a whole host of beliefs, not just one belief in isolation. So they didn't contradict the actual point that I was making. But to say that we dismiss these things out of hand or without examining the evidence is completely intellectually dishonest. I mean, there's 100 hours of The Skeptic's Guide online that you can listen to see what we actually say about stuff. And if that's too much time to invest before you may come to an opinion, you know, there are dozens of articles that we've published on the New England Skeptical Society website. I mean, we've really pretty thoroughly documented our views on these topics. Bob wrote an article, a three-part article examining the plausibility of ESP. You know, there are comprehensive reviews. We actually interviewed Ray Hyman for a very long time and in detail went over the problems with the actual evidence for ESP and psi phenomenon. So to characterize our approach to this topic as dismissing it and being closed-minded is really, sloppy.
It's absurd.
It's intellectually sloppy.
It's absurd.
Unfair. And it's actually interesting because if you pull back and say, what is really the essence of our criticism of the pro-paranormal crowd? It's basically that they're a little too credulous. They are not appropriately skeptical. They don't have an appreciation for the pitfalls of human thinking and memory and logic.
That's key there.
They tend to be at times use methodologies which are not rigorous enough. They are perhaps the worst of them are intellectually sloppy, use logical fallacies. And commonly what happens is when we criticize them for being basically poor scholarship and poor science, they say that's not true, and then they defend themselves by employing logical fallacies and sloppy scholarship.
Other than that, they're great. They're right on target.
I think you could just boil all that down to one simple thing, which is just there's no evidence.
Although that's an oversimplification in that there is evidence, but the evidence has serious problems and is not compelling. Like we talked about, Dean Radin's evaluation of the pair research, this 0.02%. They point to that as evidence.
Okay, then switch no to insufficient.
Yeah, it's not compelling. It's not sufficient. It's not compelling. There are problems with the evidence.
Pathetically lacking.
So, absolutely. But we, in detail, go over that evidence. Let me give you one other example of, which struck me as this real hypocrisy that I was talking about. So right on the heels of accusing me of an ad hominem attack and being dismissive, Marilyn basically said her response to that was that I lack emotional intelligence.
That was nasty.
Which is an ad hominem attack.
But Steve, that's
true. Right. I didn't pick up on that one.
Come on, that was blatant hypocrisy. She basically went right from saying, "Oh, that's She actually was trying not to get too upset about it. She said she didn't take it personally. Blah blah blah. It was more the interviewer was being more negative. But they went from talking about that to making a blatant ad hominem attack. So, which not that I care about, but again, it's just come on, be consistent at least.
If they're going to cherry pick quotes from this show, there are so many better ad hominem attacks. I mean, I can give you some now. Like, Sylvia Brown is a hag. There, take that out and say that that's the only reason why I don't like her. There's your ad hominem
attack.
Steve,
I got a couple points.
Go ahead, Bob.
Just a couple points from listening to this this nasty little thing for a couple times. One was, first off, I think that these two people, one with Marilyn Schlitz and Alex Securus, I believe you pronounce his name, they need tougher skin.
Yeah.
I mean, Alex was saying, he calls what Steve said personal attacks and resorting to this kind of smear
Smear.
Maryland.
Cry me a river.
Maryland. I mean, Maryland caused. Maryland called it dismissing by character assassination. What you
character
said, and going for almost an ad hominem attack. Now, here's Steve's exact quote. She also believes in a lot of kooky things, a whole suite of kooky things. Now, that quote, they're calling these, you know, character assassination, personal attacks. Come on, you know, toughen up a little bit.
You're right, Bob. And you know what? If just to extend that a little bit, this is from, you know, a pretty hardcore skeptical, you know, person and group and show. But quite honestly, if you just talk to rank-and-file scientists who aren't involved in quote-unquote skepticism, they would absolutely eviscerate those kind of people. I mean, and that kind of research. They would do it in no uncertain terms, in a very dismissive attitude. So actually, which is not really a defense. It's just saying that science is a very critical endeavor. You know, it's not just all positive.
Right.
You have to hack away what doesn't
work.
Your
colleagues are there to take you down. That is their goal.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
And just one more little thing here. Marilyn goes on at one point talking about her discourse analysis of skeptic proponent debate. Apparently for her postdoc fellowship, she did, I don't know if it was a paper or some study that she did on this discourse analysis. Basically, she analyzes skeptical arguments to find patterns and markers that signify things like dismissal. So the fact that these exist, though, say nothing about the quality of the argument. So I'm not sure why she even brought that up. I mean, shouldn't she have been looking for markers like, say, logical fallacies commonly found in skeptical discourse? Good luck finding them in Steve's arguments. But let me get to her quote, though. She says, regarding Steve's quote, she says that there's some markers of a dismissal, an attempt to undermine me, where he says, maybe she has a PhD, maybe she's a serious scientist. So he's automatically bracketing some doubt around my credentials or qualities. Now, I think she needs to do a little more discourse analysis, because that's not what Steve said. And this is a critical difference. Steve said she may have a PhD, not maybe. She may have a PhD, may be a serious researcher, but she also believes in a lot of kooky things. Now, the whole point of what Steve said was not to impugn her credentials, but to show that having a PhD does not mean you're a critical thinker. She totally misinterpreted what he said.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, she got
misinterpreted.
Making my point, actually, in doing so. She said a couple other things during the interview that are worth pointing out. She certainly invoked quantum mechanics.
Oh, my God, she pulled the quantum card. I couldn't believe
it. To say that we don't know how things really were.
I was waiting for it, actually. Okay.
Yeah, so she was saying that, you know, we don't really know how the universe works, that quantum mechanics is mysterious. So basically making an argument from ignorance that we don't know stuff so that we can't make reasoned judgments about whether or not any of these things are likely to be true or not. We have to just sort of wallow in our ignorance.
Complete relativism.
She also was very coy, you know, and saying she actually backed away from her belief, saying that I don't believe everything that I research. So, you know, fair enough. You don't necessarily have to have a belief in it, but in her writing, she certainly does say that there's compelling evidence for these things, and she thinks it's compelling enough to dedicate her research career. Yeah.
That's key. Whether she believes it or not, she's devoting valuable time to these topics, and she's got to think that there's and as she said, that she believes a lot of these things have greater potential for breakthrough, and that's part of the problem, is that we
right.
and science
and that's what
disagree.
We're talking about.
We disagree.
Not talking about religious belief. We're talking about how much stock do you put in all of this, right? She also, I mean, this is, I think, the typical tactic is to just defend curiosity. Say, I'm just being curious about these things. I'm just doing research and asking questions. I'm open-minded about these things. Right. And the implication is that we're not curious and we're not doing research and we're not, you know, open to these things. And that.
What's the old cliche? There's a difference between having an open mind and a hole in your head.
Well, yeah, there's a few where not so open that your brains fall out. But I actually had to write an article about just this whole being open-minded thing. And other skeptics have done a good job writing about that too, because it is such a common refrain among the true believers to dismiss our skepticism as being quote-unquote closed-minded. It's nonsense. You know, I am absolutely open, and we've said this before too. Again, if they really checked out our beliefs, we said, listen, I'll believe any of these things as long as the evidence is proportional to the claim that's being made. Our problem is not our worldview. It's not our that we're closed-minded, that we're defending a status quo or scientific mainstream. It's that the evidence stinks.
Right. We don't want to beat
that's our problem
a
with
dead
this.
Horse. That horse has been long dead.
I mean, it's true. Why would I possibly care if there was some hairy guy walking around in the woods? If there's Bigfoot, who cares? Be interesting, but
right.
Oh, that'd be great to have.
I don't disbelieve it.
That's not even necessarily paranormal. That's just
right.
Surviving, species. Of
I disbelieve
hominid.
It because there's no evidence. No evidence that withstands even cursory scrutiny.
She also mentioned, that we don't. We're apparently close to other cultures and.
Oh yeah, she pulled the respect for multicultural worldviews stuff too.
Yeah, she did. Right, and Sikira said the same thing. Here's a quote I wrote down of his where he says that I think it was after he said. Describes Steve's discourse as unscientific, okay. But he says, where's the science in dismissing someone else's work because they're quote-unquote kooky beliefs? Who's to judge? Especially when we take beliefs that are common across cultures and are shared by the majority of people on the planet. As a scientist, I would think you'd be curious. Maybe 100 years ago, maybe, 60 yeah. years ago, but you get to a point where you're like, no, I'm not curious anymore. There's nothing there. Move on. The show is over. Nothing to see here.
Right. Yeah, they just you could play the curiosity card infinitely. It's really very cynical in a way. Also, the same thing with like respect for other worldviews, and basically they were committing the logical fallacy of the argument ad populi.
Ah.
It's popular. Ooh. A lot of people believe in this thing, so we should take it seriously. And again, that's that's sloppy thinking, and that's why we criticize the people who argue this way. They both did that.
I don't think you should respect all other beliefs.
Yeah, some are wrong.
Yeah, some are yeah, that's some, exactly
we
right.
Some we respect logic and evidence.
Kooky.
Logic and evidence trumps what a lot of people believe or whatever, or the alternate views of other cultures. I want to make one other comment since we're kind of talking about attacks on skeptics this
yeah.
week. It's kind of a theme that will crop up a couple of times. This week on my blog, Neurological Blog, which you can get to from either the Skeptics Guide homepage or the NES homepage, I'm devoting my blog for the week on answering typical arguments against common skeptical beliefs or statements. For example, for example,
that's a classic.
The use of Occam's razor.
Yep. That was good.
The notion that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, et cetera. So those topics that we typically use to defend skepticism and to criticize beliefs which lack evidence or logic are really being attacked by certain segments of the true believer and pro-paranormal society. I mean, there's actually a website that links to Skeptico has a lot of articles that are really just attacking these foundations of skepticism, attacking skeptics. A lot of people attack James Randi. If you're high profile, you'll get targeted. And so, I as part of this, I'm sort of a companion to this week's podcast. I'm writing fairly extensive blog entries about that, so take a look at it. One more news item before we go on to emails. There is a teacher in New York that was suspended, or she was fired, actually, right?
Yeah.
For promoting witchcraft. And now she's suing the school system, basically, for I guess violating her civil rights for doing
it. She a Wiccan?
I think it said that she was Jewish.
She looks like a Yenta.
No, that's right. She was Jewish. She's Jewish.
I think she converted to Judaism.
Yeah, she did. That's right. She did.
This is Lauren Berrios. Yeah. Lauren Berrios is a
Catholic.
She
was a Jewish witch?
Who converted to Judaism. Well, they said that she wore long fingernails and dark makeup.
witch.
And sometimes
she's a witch.
She dressed in black.
A witch!
Yeah.
So, a witch.
Living God.
They fired her for promoting witchcraft because she had her students read Harry Potter.
Where have we heard this
what?
Before?
Burn her!
She taught us that Jesus died because he was weak and stupid.
Remember that? It's actually,
oh, boy.
So,
it's from The Onion.
Know.
Thank you.
Yeah.
She says she believes that the books did not mesh with the principal's religious values, and that these books they were removing them from the curriculum from the classroom, and then finally fired her.
But they fired her in like 2002. I mean, what took so long?
Yeah, it was several years ago. I don't know why it's taken this long to come to circle, but
the wheels of justice grind slowly sometimes.
Did they throw her into the gym pool and see if she sank?
Throw her off a cliff to see if she'd fly away on her broomstick?
Very small pebbles.
These stories crop up every now and then. They always do amuse me that some people in the fundamentalist community really takes very superficial you know, signs yep. as, you know, either being in league with either witchcraft or Satan or whatever. I mean, it's,
but Steve, in Hampton Bays, New York, that's not exactly, you know, we're not exactly talking
not the Bible Belt,
right? Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's that in itself is, I think, unusual.
Yeah.
Well, Salem, Massachusetts isn't in the Bible Belt either.
No, but.
Well, I guess it was.
There was a time when people thought if you played Dungeons and Dragons, you worshiped Satan, and it's yeah. all such nonsense.
Remember we went into the museum in
at the Warrens.
At the Warrens, and they had all these artifacts that they collected from their various
D&D books and their
various
the
escapades.
Museum.
And yeah, one of them was a GM. It was a D&D book, and we were laughing when we saw that. Wow.
Well, Ed and Lorraine Warren, I'll never forget when she looked at us with all the feeling in the world, and she said, "What happened to you boys? Was it the science?"
Oh, was it the science?
She did. Is that the
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Perry, show me on the doll where science touched you.
Yeah, right.
Well, let's move on to your emails. The first one comes from Michael Horn, who is the authorized American media representative for the Billy Meier contacts. I've had some email exchanges with Mr. Horn previously, and this is actually a follow-up email from him. He writes, "Dear Stephen, I noticed that you still have inaccurate info up regarding Meier. Perhaps you'd like to update your info and note what has happened to all the skeptical challenges in the last several years. These articles cover some of it." He gives a couple of links. And then he gives me another article and says, "And this should disabuse you of your thing on a string." Well, I have a funny story to tell about this whole exchange. I'm going to go over some of the pieces of it that are, I think, most amusing, and include it this week again because Michael Horn has sort of made his career from attacking skeptics. And he one thing that he does is, you know, really irritating. He basically will make an open challenge to skeptics, and then after a certain amount of time, he says, "Skeptics prove UFOs exist or Billy Meier is real because we didn't answer his challenge." You know,
whoa.
Just for a little bit of background, Billy Meier is the Swiss farmer who has basically hoaxed, in my opinion, for 30 years that he has been in contact with UFOs from the Pleiades. And, you know, again, I know we talked briefly about this before, but I had thought he died out in the 70s. But, in fact, he's still around. He's still making claims. And, in fact, he has a little UFO
they
cult.
They never go yeah. away, Steve.
He has a UFO cult following him now, and... You know, Michael Horn is his American contact, and I mean, so I'm going to tell a few stories about my contact with Michael Horn because it is really hilarious. One of the pieces of evidence that Billy Meier offered that for his contact with aliens was a photograph of two women, and he claimed that there was a blonde woman that was an alien that was named Asket, A-S-K-E-T. And from the doll universe, and a brunette in an alien was an alien named Neera. So they
this is getting sexy.
Yeah, I mean, two young, attractive women—a blonde and a brunette, Asket and Neera—and they were from a different universe, whatever that means.
Yeah.
And
I'll ask, baby.
But decided to take human form, I guess, for the encounter. I don't know if that's their native form, or if they really look human. Who knows? Now, these photos were met. With, of course, with extreme skepticism, and for good reason. First of all, they look like people, you know, not aliens. Not only that, but, you know, it's kind of like a campy sci-fi notion that the aliens are going to come here and look, you know, like people. Certainly it's...
Sexy,
you know, it's,
people.
Yeah, sexy people. It's vastly improbable that they would have evolved to look anything remotely human, you know, on another planet.
Another universe.
That might have been what he was going for, in fact. That's just completely, you know, untenable. So anyway, but it's all too convenient. Here's a picture of my aliens. It's a couple of chicks. You know, how about some actual aliens? So, of course, you know, that
sexy
was all a bit convenient. And, you know, also looking back on it, look at the photos now, and it's not only a couple of young women. It's women with, like, 1970s hairdo and makeup, you know?
Well, they're like a little behind the times in this other universe, you know? Let them,
yeah,
let them
I guess so. It's like Australia or something, right?
Aww.
You know, we have a lot of Australian listeners
who
appreciate that.
I know. I'm kidding. So these pictures are fuzzy. The background... You know, it's like there's a curtain behind them. It's not like they're in a spaceship or anything. There's absolutely nothing in the photo that you could use to validate it or to say that it has – it's useful as evidence. It's just a shit – it's a picture of two girls. You know, that's all it is. Worthless as evidence. Well –
we're wearing Disco Rules t-shirts.
But the story gets so much better than that. In 1998, Cal Korf thought he had discovered the actresses who actually were Ascot and Neera. He found a video of an early 1970 Dean Martin television show containing two girls who were backup dancers who looked suspiciously like Ascot and Neera, and in fact, in one scene, they were standing in front of a curtain that looks like the curtain on the photo.
Hmm.
That
Dean Martin worked with aliens?
So it took
basically,
it from me, Barry.
Cal Korf convincingly proved or demonstrated that this photo, that Billy Meier basically took a picture of his television set. Wendy's, you know, this variety show is on. And this is like the level of his evidence, right? So, and even a lot of hardcore UFO believers dismissed it. But, you know, but it gets better. before this time, even after, you know, Cal Korf's exposure of the photograph, you know, Meyer's inner circle of defenders would not let it go. And this one guy, Deardoff, Deardoff, wrote a letter in a UFO news group in which he argued that the picture didn't match the women, and he did this really detailed analysis of the distance between their eyes and the facial ratios. Of course, he's measuring it off a picture of a television, you know. And it was all nonsense. I mean, but he concluded that it was not them, that this it was like a superficial, you know, only a resemblance, but the picture was not of these two.
The phrenology did not match up.
Right, basically. So it's a good example of how, like, if you cherry pick your evidence and you could like focus on minute details and look for little anomalies and sort of miss literally the big picture, you can come to whatever conclusion you want. Well, the story gets even better.
No.
In the last few years, on a UFO site, they had an interview with Billy Meier, and he came clean. And Billy Meier, the man himself, says the following. He says, the photos which he has been representing as Ascot and Neera are, in fact, photos of American TV actresses.
That's the end of the story, then. We're done.
But here's what happened. He took the pictures in the early 1970s of the real Ascot and Neera. Being poor, he was too poor, apparently, to have the film developed. But, as luck would have it, a mysterious figure came out of nowhere and offered to develop his film for free. Mm. Now, because he was so poor...
Like a celestial Rite Aid.
Yeah, he handed the film over to this guy, and a few days later, the gentleman returned the photos developed to him.
He now knows...
70s.
That this guy was one of the infamous Men in Black. And what they did was they found look-alike American actresses, took pictures of them, and then substituted the pictures of the look-alike American actresses for the real Ascot and Neera.
Then
waited patiently for over two decades to use this to damage Meyer's credibility. Can you believe it? The diabolical scheming of these guys.
Hey, when is it appropriate to start using the word kook? I'm just curious.
Just wait a minute.
Evan, we are so far beyond kook. Now, listen, we left kook minutes ago. But anyway, now, you might ask the question, why did it, you know, if Meyer like physically was meeting with Ascot and Neera, why didn't he notice the substitution? Well, in fact...
That's a good question.
Why didn't the aliens warn him about all this? But he says, well, in fact, he was warned. He was warned in the 1980s. However, he forgot.
Oh, yeah.
Because they erased his memory with the pen.
Now, but the aliens didn't know. Actually, the aliens would have wanted him to know this, that his credibility was being sabotaged. He forgot about the whole thing. And because the aliens didn't know that he forgot, they didn't know to remind him.
Oh, yeah.
Until very recently.
Until very recently.
Yeah. So now they reminded him. He's like, oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot. That's what happened. It was the Men in Black with the substitute look-alike photo of the American actresses.
Right. Thank you, hot alien chicks.
That has got to be the lamest cover story I have ever heard in my life.
It's diagnosable.
It's diagnosable. But
Steve, do you have like a flow chart in front of you? I'm actually a little lost.
Men in Black. How about Men in White Coats?
Yeah.
I got a little lost after the hot chicks.
Now, Michael Horn is claiming that I'm not giving Billy Meyer a fair shake by criticizing.
Yeah, you close-minded skeptic, you.
Oh, my goodness. And of course, Dierdorf, the guy who did all the little micro-analysis of the pictures, even according to Meyer's cover story, he is now totally wrong. So it just shows you how that kind of analysis is totally worthless.
Yeah, right.
God. All right, that's story one.
Oh my!
The other thing he was referring to, the thing on a string. One of the first videos that Billy Meyer showed to the world was of a classic flying saucer. You know, the flying saucer, right? You know, swinging back and forth around a tree. Again, it's fuzzy. You can't tell how big it is. You can't tell how big the tree is. You can't tell how far away it is. But all you could see is this really childish flying saucer, you know, dangling from a string. It's childish. Childish.
To the lay observer.
Literally.
Maybe that's what they want
you to think. Is it penduluming back and forth?
The pendulum. Now, Michael Horn insists that video cannot be of a model dangling from a string. And again, you know, he cites all of this ridiculous micro-analysis when, you know, you can just look at it and see that it's dangling from a string like a pendulum. So I'm like, okay, Michael. I took, you know, still photographs of the model in various positions. And others have done this too, but I did it just to prove a point, right? And not – so the ship follows the arc just like it should – if it's, you know, swinging from a string like a pendulum, it's following a pendulum arc. Mm-hmm. And then Michael said, "Yes, but if it were dangling from a string, whatever it was suspending from should be in the frame. It should be in the frame. So, and why don't we see it?
Yeah, because how can you suspend something from a string without your hand in the picture?
First of all, the picture is of sufficiently poor quality that there could be something there that we're not seeing. But actually, I did a very simple thing. I just, you know, I drew a perpendicular line through the central axis of each like still photo of the flying saucer, mm-hmm. and then. I did that like of five or six different places in the pendulum arc. And guess what? The lines roughly intersect way above the frame of the shot.
That doesn't prove anything.
Right. So,
yes, Steve, that's just math, okay?
Yeah. I mean, I'll have all the pictures and everything on the notes page. I mean, you can judge for yourself. I mean, it's really obvious.
Also, did the saucer stay within the frame of the camera? Did it ever like leave the frame, or was it always within the picture?
It was always within the frame of the camera.
Red flag.
Yeah, the anchor point is above the frame so that you wouldn't see what it was dangling from. Now he's like citing some analysis by some guy who says that the ship moves in such a way that's not consistent with a pendulum, saying, well, yeah, it bounces around a little bit. You know, it's not like in a perfect pendulum. Yeah, but accounting for a little bit of bouncing.
The person holding the pole attached to the string to the thing was not perfectly still, correct?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know.
Perhaps he sneezed.
Ed Wood would have been very proud of his.
Ed Wood would have been proud. Absolutely. The third one is now
plan
my
zero from outer space.
Billy Meyer plan zero. Yeah.
Whatever.
The third thing that was really funny was Michael Horn claims that Billy Meyer is now a prognosticator a la Nostradamus.
Sure, why not?
That he has confirmed predictions. So I'm like, all right, Michael, give me your best shot. I'm just saying, I'm not going to read through 1,000 things. I'm not going to read 100 pages. Just give me his one best prediction, and I'll look into that. And he sent me this prediction. It says, the danger of accidents in nuclear reactors will increase throughout the world. Regarding the subject, France in particular must be extraordinarily careful in every way. For one prophecy warns of an accident near the city of Lyon, which can be prevented as long as the responsible individual takes the right steps. A prophecy can be changed. So first of all, that's vague as hell and has the escape hatch of it could be avoided, right? What's he talking about? And then Michael said, and then this happened, like some indeterminate time later, there was some kind of nuclear event happened in one of the reactors in France. Now, France has a lot of nuclear reactors.
A lot. They are big on
nuclear. So if I were going to predict a nuclear incident, it would be in France.
You bet.
I looked at the year in question, and there were like 30 or 40 incidents that year, and the one that Michael Horn was citing as evidence that the prophecy came true wasn't even the most dramatic one. I mean, they're graded like, you know, in steps of how severe they were. There were even more severe ones. So this is just using a vague prediction with a high probability hit and the escape hatch, and there hasn't been a major nuclear event in France. There's just the background of events that happen, you know. So that proves absolutely
that was the creme de la creme of
that was
prediction.
It.
The best
that
one
was,
he could offer.
That was the best one he can offer. So
that prediction, she stinks.
Ask it in Nera photos are laughable. The flying saucer dangling pendulum style from a string
is
childlike,
stupid.
And the prophecy is worthless. So I do, Michael, you're right. I do have to update our web entry on Billy Meyer. It needs to be a lot more scathing, negative, and critical than what we have up there right now.
I mean, maybe this Horn guy is actually Michael using a pseudonym or something. I mean,
Billy just, Meyer.
Billy Meyer uses a pseudonym. I mean, come on.
Perhaps
he's going around harassing everybody. He's been harassing Randy. He's been harassing the CFI West. And those could be, you know, Jim Underdown and those guys over there. You know, this
who
is
could be
life.
Moved by that guy's evidence. I mean, jeepers.
Hey, note to Skeptico, feel free to use these segments in any way you see.
Maybe Skeptico could interview... They can interview Michael Horn.
That'd oh, yeah. Go fun. For him, guys. Go get him.
Kookzilla.
So this week, we have a Name That Logical Fallacy. We haven't done this in a while. Usually, just because we run out of time, and it happens, it's usually the segment that gets jettisoned. But I'm going to try to make a higher priority, since a lot of people have been asking for it on email and on the boards. So this one was sent in by Simon Roberts from Washington State, United States. And Simon sent us this email. I'm a big fan of the show, been listening to the archives in order, and am up to around episode 45. I consider myself to be a pretty skeptical person, but perhaps I am too skeptical. Although I don't typically buy into grand conspiracies, I find myself sometimes skeptical of your criticisms thereof. It seems to me that although it is logically plausible that most, if not all, grand conspiracies would collapse under their own weight, it seems at least slightly fallacious to say that they can't be true simply because you can't imagine how they would be perpetrated and kept secret. This strikes me as nothing more than an argument from personal incredulity. I think that even the best skeptics must guard at all times against fallacious thinking. After all, none of us are infallible. Thanks for the podcast. Keep up the good work. So Simon is talking here, of course, about the argument from personal incredulity, which is basically saying that something isn't true or can't be true because I can't imagine it, or I can't imagine how it could be true. The most common example of this is creationists, who will typically say that, you know, I can't imagine creatures as complex as humans evolving over time, which is not a valid argument. They're just basically saying that nature is somehow limited to their imagination.
I'm too ignorant to understand the science, therefore I can't imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
In this case, the argument with grand conspiracies that we've made in the past is that they tend to collapse under their own weight, meaning that the more people that have to be involved in a conspiracy, the greater the probability that one of those people are going to betray the conspiracy. They're going to leak. If you a conspiracy among three or four people, you know, there's a reasonable probability that you can keep it, although even sometimes that doesn't work. But if 10 people, 100 people, 1,000, 10,000, you know, at some point there are so many people that would have to be involved, the sheer probability of everyone keeping the secret becomes impossible. I mean, the probability becomes vanishingly small, and that's what we mean by collapsing under its own weight. So in this particular case, and I emailed Simon back on this, and I think he basically agrees with me, that this really isn't an argument from personal incredulity. So at times we may have said words similar to, I can't imagine how a conspiracy like that could possibly function. But we then went on to explain it in deep, not so we weren't relying upon our personal incredulity. We were saying that basically it collapses under its own weight. It's just too difficult for so many people to keep the conspiracy, especially one that's so huge, you know, one that would have such tremendous implications.
And the thing is, they don't have any explanation for how to overcome that incredulity.
Right.
If somebody says to us, I don't see how it's possible that the eye could evolve naturally, that's an argument from incongruity, and we can combat that by saying, here is the step-by-step guide.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And if they still reject it, then that is fallacious. But when we say we can't understand how so many people could be involved in this conspiracy, they have nothing to say to that.
A couple of things that they would say, which themselves are not very compelling. One is, well, everyone keeps the secret because if they didn't, they would be killed, which
right. –
is really just moving it back a step. They're saying that the people managing the conspiracy have so much reach and so much power that they could keep all of these people in line, which really isn't an answer. You know, part of the problem is that, you know, not everybody would have the same motivation to keep the conspiracy. You would need to involve a lot of people who are pretty far down the food chain. And, you know, would probably have more to gain by not keeping the conspiracy. Then they often simultaneously argue that, one, the people who have exposed the conspiracy are running around saying there's a conspiracy, but if anyone else did that, they would be killed, and therefore they're living in fear. So those two things probably would not coexist side by side. Because, you know, why wouldn't they just kill the conspiracy theorist if they had that much power and that much reach? It doesn't save the grand conspiracy from being unwieldy and unmanageable and from being too big to possibly exist for a long period of time without anyone breaking the secret. So as a general principle, there's a difference between saying that something is a certain way and saying that something is wrong because it's a certain way. Right, so this applies to multiple logical fallacies. In this case, we could say, you know, this is incredible, but that's not why it's wrong. It's incredible, but it's wrong because of these specific reasons. And just like we might say someone's a kook, that's not why they're wrong. You know, so it's not an ad hominem logical fallacy if we followed up with a detailed analysis of why they're wrong. And by the way, they also happen to be a kook. That's different than saying they're wrong because they have this negative quality, or this is wrong because it seems incredible to me. That's the difference between, you know, just talking in an entertaining fashion as we do sometimes and actually committing a logical fallacy.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine, one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake.
Challenge accepted.
Are you guys ready for this week's?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
All righty. Number one. Scientists are exploring an area of the Atlantic seafloor thousands of kilometers in area where the Earth's crust appears to be missing. Number two, neuroscientists use fMRI scanning to show how toothbrushing can cause seizures. And item number three, plant biologists have genetically engineered a variety of green bean plant that grows over 8 feet tall and sports beans over 1 foot long. Evan, why don't you go first?
The Atlantic seafloor is missing crust. Okay. I think I can believe that. Neuroscientists investigating whether brushing teeth causes seizures?
Mm-hmm. Toothbrushing causes seizures, yep.
I don't know about that. And the last one was 8 foot green bean plants and 1 foot long green beans. I'll say that one, green bean, foot-long green beans, is fiction.
Okay, Bob?
This one's tough. Earth crust is missing. I mean, that it, on the face of it, that makes no sense because we, I mean, even with our deepest drills, we have barely scratched the surface of the crust, not even coming close to the mantle. Yet there's an area here that does not have, that's not the crust. It's made of the upper mantle. I mean, how would you even, that doesn't sound right, but it's, it sounds like a red herring to me. fMRI showing that brushing your teeth can cause seizures, that seems feasible with the, you got some repetitive motion like that. Right on your head, kind of like those lights on the in those those video games or some anime.
it reminds me
of that. Right. The green bean plant, 1 foot. I mean, I could see some funky variety. I mean, we're not going to be seeing these at Shaw's anytime soon, I'm sure. Probably some weird variety that was just kind of a proof of concept.
Foot long.
1 foot. Mm-hmm. That doesn't sound good either. Yeah, I'm just going to default to the crust because that doesn't make any sense. The crust.
Okay.
No, that's a red herring. I'm going with the 1 foot beans.
Okay. Yay, the foot long club.
We do.
Okay, Perry.
He took so goddamn long. I just.
The 1 foot beans are true. I saw them in Woody Allen's Sleeper, right? So he was riding giant canoe sized bananas and things. So that's true. The toothbrushing, you know, it's, I mean, that's very dangerous. That's why I never do it. And so that's probably true. And then the other one, that one doesn't make any sense, obviously. There's a lot of lava and shit in there, but. I'll go with that one. I think the lava.
The crust?
Crust.
Okay, so everyone agrees that toothbrushing can cause seizures.
Of course.
And that neuroscientists are using an fMRI
very
to
dangerous.
Show this. And that is science. And Bob, you hit upon the key there, is that it's a repetitive sort of sensory stimulation.
Of course. Very dangerous.
And there are people who actually, it's interesting, there are epileptics of many different varieties who can have their seizures triggered by all sorts of sensory input. Certain snatch of music, you know, not only flashing lights, certain kind of sensory input. And there are some people who will get seizures from brushing their teeth. And it is because of the sort of rhythmic, you know, sensory input that produces, you know, the electrical activity, which can then, you know, turn into a seizure.
How did
and
what they find did is that they, out? Was it the they, science
Was
thing?
It the science
Was it the science? They used fMRI, functional MRI scanner, that could image the brain activity, you know, in real time, basically. And they show that the somatosensory area of the cortex becomes activated and it becomes the focus of a seizure when they brush their teeth. So it's a neat little study.
Now, Steve, does it have to be near the head? I mean, could it be something like, a vibrator? No. Could that cause it?
Could be on your toe. Yeah, it's just that... You know, but toothbrushing is something that you do every day that involves the sort of rhythmic stimulation, right? So that doesn't sound right. at any rate, that was what they studied.
Ninth Symphony, fourth movement.
The Perry, you think that the...
Yes, unfortunately.
Scientists exploring an area of the Atlantic Ocean... The Atlantic seafloor, thousands of kilometers in area where the Earth's crust appears to be missing. And that one...
Science.
Is science.
Good.
What is science?
Good.
Very interesting. And you're right, Bob. It does sound, you know, rather fantastical. But in fact, they found that there's
this rather
large area.
I thought they had the ocean floor mapped.
Well, this is really deep near the mid-Atlantic.
Is it by the Marianas Trench, the deepest part of the ocean?
Yeah, this is being investigated by Dr. Chris McLeod from Cardiff University. They're sending a ship out there. They want to do some drilling. And basically, what they found is there's an area several thousand square kilometers where there appears to be mantle sort of peeking up in between the crust. So there's a discontinuity in the crust at this area in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Very, very far. I think it's like 3 miles down from the surface of the ocean. So they're not sure what opened up this wound or gash or whatever in the Earth's crust. Normally, you have the unless you're Neil Adams, you believe that there's the magma comes up in the mid oceanic ridge and then spreads outward. So the seafloor is pulling apart because of subduction. And then magma rises up in the middle.
Did you say seduction?
Subduction. You know, so
Just making sure.
Yeah, the Earth's crust sort of dives down below the continental plates, and then and fresh magma rises up in the middle to replace, to fill it in. But here's an area where apparently that's not happening, so there's a little gap where there should be crust.
I don't like it. It sounds fishy.
It does not seem to be repairing itself.
That's actually pretty interesting, though, because
it's very interesting.
So now, I mean, you could relatively easily access the mantle without having to drill through many, many miles. I think it's 15 or 30 miles. You can go, bam, just, you know, of course it's difficult to get that deep in the ocean, but it's a lot easier than going 20 or 30 miles into the crust, so that's actually pretty cool.
I wonder what kind of life forms are living right there. That must be amazing.
Bacteria, that's my guess.
Amazing
we'll
bacteria.
See. So all of this means that the 8-foot-tall green bean plants with 1-foot-long beans is fiction. So most of you guys got that correct. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I'll admit I only saw a banana, not a bean plant.
Yeah, it's a funny pair. I was gonna joke about the whole Sleeper movie as well. That's kind of what inspired this fiction piece.
You had the guts to fall for the trail.
Yes, you did.
However, this was also inspired by a real bit of news. Plant scientists have been successful in isolating the genes that are responsible for determining plant size, and they've been able to turn small plants into large plants and large plants into small plants and by manipulating these genes. And the hope is that they will be able to produce, you know, supersized agricultural plants a la Sleeper. So it may be in 10 or 20 years that we'll be, you know, we'll have those kind of really supersized vegetables in agriculture.
Excellent.
So they've taken the first step, but no 8-foot bean plants yet.
Just think of the French fries you could have. Supersized,
so the footlong club won this week.
Congratulations to everyone for winning. Good job.
Thanks. Thank you.
Supersized fries.
Evan, last week's puzzle.
I am holding 5 objects in my hand. All 5 objects are the same size and shape. Each object has a number of things on them. These things are all exactly the same. The first object has 0 things. The second has 4. The third has 6. The fourth has 4. The fifth has 10. What am I holding? And the answer is... I am, in fact, holding the Zener ESP cards.
Ah.
Horse, please. With numbers like 0, 4, 6, 4, and 10. And, of course, I was referring to the things as the endpoints that appear on each of those cards. So the first one is a circle. So, by definition, it has no endpoints. The second one is a plus sign. It has 4. The third one has 3 wiggly lines. Therefore, it has 6. The fourth one is a square. Therefore, it has 4. And the last one is a star, 5-pointed star. If you include the interior points, that makes 10. And congratulations goes out to Ian and Bert, IANDBERT, from the message boards, who guessed correctly.
Very good. Yeah, actually, the 0 was the giveaway for me there. Actually, because I don't know if you're aware of this, but the Zener cards are supposed to evoke the numbers 0, 1, 2, 3.
And, I thought 1 through 5.
No, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So the circle has one side.
One line.
Or one line. Yeah. The plus is 2, the 3 wavy lines, the 4-sided square, then the 5-pointed star. So that's
but
how
it is. I was able to find something deeper in the Zener cards that few people, I'm sure, have observed.
It was certainly deep.
Well, that's old news. Let's get on to some new.
And yes, what's the puzzle for this week?
Here's this week's puzzle. A pirate's victim, swimming in rye, bound with ropes, would make a perfect one of these. Good luck, everyone.
Very short and extra pithy.
Very good.
You're welcome.
Thank you,
Evan.
Enjoy,
everyone.
I must say the puzzles get the most discussion on the message boards about the episode.
They do all
the things we talk about on the episode. People spend the most time.
They do,
talking about
especially
your puzzles.
when it takes them a while to figure it out. Boy, is there a lot of.
I have to remember the people on the forums are a very distinct subset of our listeners.
As Rebecca would say, they are some of the coolest people out there. No doubt about
Indeed
it.
They are. I would never say
very
that. Though.
Limited quality.
Oh, and on that note, we are going to start putting up a separate post in which we can just discuss the puzzles and riddles each week.
As opposed to
the one Steve puts up, in which we can talk about the other aspects of the podcast. So keep your eyes open for that, everyone.
And just a quick reminder, the first of our premium content, The Skeptic's Guide Uncut, is available from our website. So if you want another hour of The Skeptic's Guide to listen to, take a listen. And again, I'll just ask our listeners to take a moment to vote for The Skeptic's Guide and for episodes that you like on Dig, because that will help raise our profile and get The Skeptic's Guide to more people. So we appreciate...
Give us reviews on iTunes.
We appreciate everything you do to help support The Skeptic's Guide and to get the word out there.
Gracias.
Bob, close out the show with a nice quote for us.
Okay, this one came from Steve. Thank you, Steve, for this good quote. From quote from Thomas H. Huxley, Darwin's bulldog. He said, "The deepest sin against the human mind is to believe things without evidence."
Nice.
He was a very eloquent
guy. Which we discussed on today's podcast.
Yes, we did.
That's for sure.
In detail. Well, that was apropos.
Well, thank you, everyone, for joining me again.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Jay will be back next week. He does wish to say hi to everyone, but we will have him. We will have him back from
Jay.
Hawaii next week.
Aloha.
Yeah, he's got some. He's got some good pseudoscience stuff from Hawaii. He's been doing some research.
Excellent.
Oh, good.
While he's been out there.
Excellent. So we'll look forward to that. So thanks again for joining me. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.